Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes and sports people battling the challenges that elite sport can bring both during and after their careers. The themes we'll cover this time around are applicable to all sports, but our guests today are all drawn from the world of rugby after the Rugby Players Association recently launched their Lift the Weight campaign to target removing the stigma surrounding mental health. The aim is to offer members the necessary tools and support to enjoy a healthy and fulfilling life both on and off the field. One in four of us in the UK this year will be affected by mental health difficulties, with the most common issues being depression and anxiety, with the pressures and strains of elite sport often magnifying the situation for professional sports people. I'm Mark Clement. This podcast is brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World. Alongside me, my co-host Scott Ward, a retired professional footballer who's spent the last 10 years working in athlete welfare, leading to the creation of EY's personal performance program. And obviously, Scott, this is an issue that is much, much wider than just sport. So do you think sport has to act as a figurehead as we all become a little more open with our emotions in letting out what's inside, lead the way for society?
Yeah, I do. I think if we look at how athletes are perceived by fans, you've got that real opportunity of opening up a dialogue that previously may have had a bit of resistance towards it. You mentioned about the stats there in rugby. It's closer to 2 out of 3 within 3 years of leaving the professional game, and that's quite an alarming statistic. I think
it's alarming. A couple of our guests sitting here.
That's and I'm sorry to bring it up, chaps. But I think that's the reality that sport poses. And like, you know, the reason we're here today is to talk about this. And as soon as we can start to become comfortable with the fact that it's here and that we can help and that we can diminish those statistics through conscious effort, the better tomorrow will look for all of us.
Well, I do hope we don't get locked in the studio recording this latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, because if we do, Harlequins are going to struggle to put a tee out for their next match, as we're joined by their co-captain and former captain of Australia, James Horwell, fullback Aaron Morris, a man who's been doing a little bit of work experience at EY, lock forward Matty Simmons, and hoping that if we do get locked in, nobody suggests an impromptu match against the Harlequins guys, as it'll be him, Scott and me to face them, recently retired former Leicester Tigers and England utility back Matthew Tate. Just for the sake of this, I'm going to make you Matty and you Matthew, otherwise things could get very confusing. Is that okay? Now listen, you're on the RPA committee, and obviously you Quinns guys, that's Matthew I'm talking to, and the rest of you share a changing room with Mark Lambert, who's the RPA chairman. So has he shared, James, exactly why this Lift the Weight campaign has become such a priority with you?
Well, I think Mark has been part of the RPA for a long time, and he's been very good to getting across to us why it's important. I think everyone understands now that it is important because of the things you were touching on before. It does affect all of us in some way, by either directly or by knowing people that have actually been affected by mental health seriously. And there's also different levels of mental health. And I think opening the conversation, which Mark has been sort of certainly promoting with the players, is really important. And as we spoke about, that it's the more you open, the more you talk about it, the more relief and the better, I guess, people get it out there in the public domain. It can be a real weight off people's shoulders, as the Lift the Weight campaign is called.
Mm. Has it been long a talking point, Matthew, when you've had those committee meetings? Has this been something we've been brewing up to for 6, 12, 18 months, or has it been quite sudden?
No, it's something that's been building up to. I think as sports people, you don't want any element of what you do to be perceived as weakness, and to actually, if you allow yourself to be vulnerable, it can also be perceived as a weakness, and the mental issue and addressing that is hugely important. And I think the RPA does a great job in terms of addressing that, providing the support for players. Still got a huge way to go with that. And the charity that supports that, I know, is under pressure now, because actually it's been utilised by the players, which is great in one aspect, that actually players are reaching out. They know it's there to help them get through whatever problems they may be having, but actually then addresses the issue around raising the funds to continue to support the players.
Yeah, this is exactly it, Scott, isn't it? You know, you open the door and you go, right, come on, it's good to talk, But then, of course, you've got to have the resources and the framework in place to be able to service the demand when it comes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think if you look at that example, Matthew, where, you know, perhaps as an industry, we're having to be reactive because we've not always had the facilities for the players historically. You know, it posed the question, shall we look at prevention rather than cure? Because if we're being reliant on a delivery model that is hoping for players to come to us, and then, of course, that creates huge stress on our resource, can we demonstrate or create something that will help athletes understand their own societal place, accept that vulnerability that you take on as part of, as being an athlete, and try and stop this from happening? I think we'll all agree it's a far more productive way to be, for all reasons, rather than as I say, being reliant and having to install more counselors, for example, into the clubs.
Mm. I'm fascinated, and this is a question for all of you, about how pressure manifests itself. I said, you know, in elite sport, Matty, that you're under that extra bit more scrutiny. But how do you feel pressure, and how do you feel it?
Yeah, I definitely feel pressure. I just think it's a different job to your normal 9-to-5. That has its own stresses, but we've got injuries to deal with. Our contracts, let's say the average contract's 2 years at a time, but within 1 year, you'll get a feeling if that's going to get extended or not, or if you're taking a pay cut, pay rise. And that's every week you're performing and you're out there. So, you know, one game, you might play a blinder. The next week, goes horribly wrong. And that's a pressure in itself. You're not dealing with those kind of longer time frames where it's every quarter, you know, a once a year appraisal. Ours is every week. And we're getting constant feedback. And that has, that causes its own stress.
Yeah, for all them reasons you just said, that our job is kind of tailored to kind of mental health difficulties, because the pressures you just mentioned. I speak to friends, and there's no other job where you're on a Monday to Friday basis critiqued by fellow players, coaches, fans, and then you go out in front and have to perform in front of 15,000 people. And it takes a very resilient person to not feel them pressures sometimes. And yeah, for myself personally, I definitely have struggled, and I'm only 24, but have had to work at how I approach my kind of day-to-day life and my career to make sure them things don't get on top of me.
But I thought coaches were coached to critique not the name, but the number or the position, and for you guys not to personalise the criticism.
Yeah, that's certainly a point. Obviously, every coach sort of says it's for the betterment of the team, but it is tough to not take things personally, you know, when someone's critiquing, whether it's your work ethic, you know, things like that, or your skill ability. And I think along all that being a professional sportsman is a lot like a roller coaster. The emotions ranging from day to day to almost week to week. You can be really high after a win, you've had a great result. Next week you lost or you get injured, you then bottom out again. And it's not having the consistency that I guess most other people would have in a workplace or in a life. It's you're sort of up and down, up and down. And then you've got the extra stresses that everyone else has to get along with life. You've got, you know, relationships, partners, you know, family trouble, all that else to deal with on top of this sort of up and down, up and down, up and down. And I think it does certainly, as Aaron and Maddie have said.
Your choice, you can go Simo if you want.
Simo have said that it's sort of manifests itself in a way that can be quite difficult. And if you're not open about talking about it and understanding what, you know, with other people, then it can become quite a negative and a snowballing effect.
I'm just quite curious to drill down on that notion of the contract looming, that you're kind of carrying that with you at all times as well, are you? Oh, crikey, you know, I've only got 6 months or 9 months left. And do you almost feel that every tackle you go into, every run that you make might contribute to your financial betterment?
Yeah, good question. Everyone's different. Some guys perform better if they're always on a one-year contract.
Yeah.
And they're playing for that contract or the next one. Some guys like stability and they like to sign a 3-4 year deal as long as they can get, essentially, even if it's less money, to have that security. It's a tricky one. The worst part is when you're up for a contract and it's all kicking off, other clubs might be coming in, you're talking to your current employer, and you're out there on the open market, your agent's ringing you 5 times a day when you're at training, and you've got to nail down a starting spot or, you know, get selected in that 23 to go out and perform, and all eyes are on you. That's incredibly tough, I think. But for young guys, you know, 18, 19, 20, out of school, into that environment, is tough.
I think the word, excuse me, that Aaron mentioned there is resilience. I think in sport we always focus on performance resilience, but very seldomly do we mention your personal resilience as an individual. Without one, there's not another, and yet it's not something that we really focus on. Now, clearly, if we can enhance somebody's perception of what's valuable to them, their personal identity, being able to facilitate all of these thoughts and challenges that you're facing you on a daily basis, will become simpler. But they're not given the time to do that, and this goes back to the mental health within sport. Clearly, with an enhanced view of themselves and what goes on around them, that elevation of pressure could be potentially diminished slightly. And I think your view of the world will change. I mean, people often speak about it when you have a child, for example. You know, your viewpoint changes. I would say your level of intensity can shorten in terms of what really motivates you against what doesn't. And I think that stems from having discussion and opening up those doors to say, look, we quite understand that what you're doing is important to you because it's your vocation. But there is a life beyond sport, and you need to understand that you can't commit anything today that is going to cost you long term, especially, you know, when you have children or family, because those long term ramifications last a lot longer than the short term justifications do.
We talk about pressure. I'm trying to imagine what it feels like to be carrying the weight and expectations of a country as well into a World Cup final, and albeit into a World Cup final that followed on from a World Cup final that was one of the greatest sporting moments in history. That again, scrutiny and everybody hanging on your every run.
To be honest, when we went into that tournament in 07, there wasn't a huge amount of pressure because actually the build-up into that, we hadn't been that good, to be perfectly honest. So we went into the tournament and actually we didn't play particularly well in the first game against America. We were well beaten by South Africa in the second game. And then almost the pressure lifted. It kind of freed everyone up, and we played Tonga, we won, and then obviously we went down to Marseille and we played against an Australian team, which on paper was just, not to rub it in, James, but it was just ridiculous in terms of the talent available to them. But for whatever reason, it just clicked, and that from that point, the whole journey was, we were kind of every match, every day there was a bonus. I was 21 and playing in the finals, so I guess ignorance is bliss to a certain extent. But at that point, I'd had obviously a reasonably tricky experience in 2005 on my international debut as an 18-year-old. And again, going into that to a certain extent, ignorance was bliss. I'd always been a rugby fan, so I knew the importance of the game against Wales. But until you're in the kind of the cauldron of the Millennium Stadium and things don't necessarily go to plan, you talk about trying to be resilient. I'd worked hard through school, through the time at Newcastle, and actually my hard work had always been reflected in success. And actually that was the first major setback in terms of my career to that point that I'd had. And I was really lucky. I had a really tight family support group, a really good friend group and peers at my club I could call upon for that support. And you're just constantly learning. And by the time we got to the 2007, the final, you know, I felt part of that squad, felt as if I should be there. Unfortunately, we lost, but actually, in hindsight, I probably should have taken that more for granted. I remember doing media post the game and was asked about it and said I'd be disappointed, but it would drive me for the next one in 4 years' time. And unfortunately for me, I never got to do it again in 4 years' time. So from that perspective, it's, as a sportsman, you're just trying to, you live and enjoy the moment. And I don't necessarily think when you're involved in it, you do that. It's not until you've got time now, as I have, to reflect on that, actually you can appreciate the things you have achieved.
Mm. The numbers, I mean, you talk about watching it. I always make the analogy of, let's say you're a roofer and you're on a roof there and you're putting on a critical ridge tile and you knock the corner off of it, Aaron. You know, imagine if that roofer had 15, 20,000 people all around going, "You idiot, you've smashed the roof tile. I'm going to tell your boss about this," and things. It's a pressure that the general public just could not comprehend that you elite sport people go through.
Yeah, definitely. And
are you any good at ridge tiling, by the way?
I'm not. Okay. I've worked in a call centre before. Definitely, and I think one of the cliches that's kind of rolled out a bit is like, oh, you run over the whitewash and there's just another game. But for the more conscientious bloke, which I'd like to think I am, when you mess up, you worry, you think of potentially what that might mean to you following week. And most importantly, you're thinking about how you may have let down the people around you. And that's the biggest thing.
More than the crowd. So it's teammates first, more than the crowd.
Yeah, always. I think it's the nature of our game, kind of putting yourself into a bit of a hole and just going through some physical pain on an 80 minutes, you kind of build a level of trust and an emotional connection amongst you. And when things go badly on a personal level, the main disappointment is that I've let the other guys down. There's obviously personal things and, oh, I might not get picked next week. But if I'm thinking Kev, Simo, I'm probably thinking, oh, Aaron's got that wrong. That's the thing that kind of bugs me more.
What about a mistake in the early stages, Simo? What about you make a mistake early stages? How do you isolate that off, push it to one side and think, hell, I've still got 60 minutes to go. I need to concentrate on being good or great for the rest of the match. How do you process mistakes when you're out there?
I'm an overthinker, so it's always tough.
Do you? Like, so first, it, yeah, it's first there five with you everywhere
yeah,
you
if
go.
You're like into the game a little bit and you make a mistake, you're like, okay, I'll brush that off. First 5-10 minutes is tough if you do make a couple, especially if you're like in a leadership role. So it's a line out and you've got a plan all week that you've had in place. First line out gets stolen, you're like, okay, great. Back to square one. And then let's say the second one gets stolen and you're like, right, we're in a bit of a pickle here. And trying to galvanise the lads, get a plan B. Yeah, that's tough. And you know, experience is huge and repetition as well. Get it right in training. You talk about your Millennium Stadium experience. That kind of stuff stays with you. Yeah. And I can look back at errors I've made and things that I'd change. I'm a lot calmer now, I'd say, than not when I used to be.
You sometimes got to have almost selective memory. You know, like you remember some things but don't remember other things.
Yeah.
And that's mid-game, that's after games. It's you almost like can't focus too much on it because it'll weigh you down. But there are guys, certainly, that think a lot and overthink. And that can have that snowball effect we're talking about.
You know, you could, other sports, obviously, I played football. Aaron just said there, the first high ball, you know, as a goalkeeper. There's nothing worse being in your area and you hear the opposite gaffer go, put it on the keeper. Because straight away you start to wobble. Yeah. But that's what happens. And sometimes, you know, you do make mistakes, but it's about, you know, what they term as the bounce back ability, right? And that's what sets these guys aside from others. Because, yes, it's hard to take. They're human beings. You know, their ego will take a bit of a battering if they mess up. But it's about what they do next. And that next action can be just as powerful as the previous one. So I think that's when you start to decipher those that do it as a profession against those who have perhaps got to a different level and not just got over that leap.
It's also something a bit of a process to excuse me to get over things. So from the early days, you know, as we mentioned, that first high ball, I mean, I've had stinkers playing against Toulouse in the snow and I dropped everything and I knew as soon as they got the ball next time they were kicking it up on me and I was probably going to drop it even. and I did. But it's just, you learn from that, and we work with Leicester, fortunate to have a great sports psychologist, and it's just about, you have a process to get over stuff and actually realise that a mistake is not deliberate and it's something in isolation. It doesn't have to influence your next action, and it's being able to snap yourself out of that mindset. Whether that's a trigger, like I randomly used to reset myself by pressing my belly button was always my bizarre thing.
Was set up as a sort of what? Sort of neurolinguistic program related sort of.
So I've messed up, I've dropped a high ball. That's kind of right. That's the trigger. What's the next thought process? I know I've caught hundreds of high balls. I know that it's tight elbows. It's looking, it's watching the ball. It's hands together. You know the process. There's no reason why that one mistake should then impact on the two.
Thank goodness he's retired, eh? Otherwise, you'd all be pressing his belly button every time.
That's so intriguing because, you know, you look at when you play a good game and you have your lucky slips or you have the same socks, or there are so many silly things that you take into elite sport because you think they make a difference, and in retrospect, they don't. It's about what you do as yourself. And it's funny that we take that really poignant thought process into being active athletes. But sometimes we don't think about that readiness, that preparation for life beyond. So we go through our processes, don't we? We map out our strategy during game week. We'll make sure that we ready ourselves for what's next, but we don't talk about that same commitment towards your next cycle beyond sport. And yet it probably needs even more commitment. It's just understanding the importance and the gravitas that both hold, and giving the space, the time to think and to get things wrong, but knowing that that's not going to define you beyond sport.
Does an experienced captain learn to manage the emotional state of some of his players? You will learn the ones that might need a little prop up if they've made a couple of mistakes.
Yeah, I think you learn when you're with people what makes them tick, and also, you know, there's certain people in groups that, you know, aren't going to respond well to, you know, when mistakes are made, to being pointed out that something's made wrong, and there's others that will, you know, just want an arm around them and make them feel a bit more comfortable that, you know, it's not that bad, it's going to be okay, because there's big moments in big games. You know, we're talking about test matches, a lot of people watching, and people, you know, make mistakes. It's just natural, we're human beings, and not everyone's perfect, and no one's perfect really with what we do. So it's about understanding what makes them tick, and, you know, and I think understanding people more as a captain is really important. Understanding where they're from, what their background is, what their family situation is, because then you understand, you know, what they're doing it for, their motivations as to why they're out there, why they're putting themselves through it, what they're doing. And I think the more you understand about the people, the better you can understand about managing disappointments more than successes, because success is easy because it's all going well and everyone's slapping on the back. It's when, you know, I was saying that roller coaster, when it drops off that edge for that little bit where it might be a small drop or a big drop, it's about understanding what is going through that person's head then to get them back up to the next level.
Scott mentioned possibly the stats in rugby as high as 2 in 3, suffering some sort of mental health related issue. Do you know why? You know why, Aaron? Has anybody shared that with you?
I think it's difficult to put any particular, put your finger on it, but I think going back to what I and what Simo said earlier, I think the career is kind of shaped towards putting people down that unfortunate kind of channel, having kind of brevity of contracts, and it's difficult with for them boys who are kind of in a squad of 50 people majority of the time, and there's your I'd say there's 20 boys who are regular rotation players, there's your 10 kind of young boys who are breaking in, and then the majority are the kind of your battlers. Yeah. And they're the boys who are on maybe a 1 year, maybe a 2 year deal. And it comes to, and it's around this time of the year, isn't it? Kind of November to January. And it's sweaty palms, you're playing for a contract. Nothing happens by kind of the new year. You realise it's not going to happen. And then you factor in things like mortgages, families, and financial pressures into that, as well as anything else that can be going on in your personal life. It's hard. And I think that can be a massive push towards mental health issues.
Have you been coached as a changing room to counsel your teammates? It's all right having this mental health initiative, but presumably a starting point might be a freedom to talk to a colleague. So have you been given any pointers as to how to draw people out? It's a question for any of you.
I mean, I guess, you know, for the first time this season, the club, we sort of sat down and actually had a little talk about trying to talk about what the pressures are, what you're going through individually. And I've sort of played professional rugby for 15 years, and that was the first time I'd ever had that put in front of me. And like an actual, you get spoken about it, and there's like flyers that get sent out and emails that get sent around saying, oh, you should talk, lift the weight, talk to this person. But it was the first time we actually sat in a group and you split up into little teams and said, okay, we need to talk about this. What is going on with each and one of you? How are you feeling? You know, what are the stresses? What are the pressures? What are the signs? And I think that's a good step in the right direction, but it's certainly not the final step. But for me, that was the first time I've had it. And as I said, I've been sort of playing rugby in two different countries for 15 years, and that was the first time it's ever been brought.
So officially formalised.
Formalised it, rather than saying, you know, we should do this and you should talk to people and talk, because it's all well and good to say it, but it's actually about going through the process of doing it.
Mm. When we did that, I remember it was kind of in the schedule, mental health talk, and everyone went, oh God, I can't get home. Won't be home for early, I'll miss whatever, deal or no deal. And kind of moaning about it. And then got in there, I think it was a half an hour slot, and I think to a man, every group had to get pulled out of that room. Like the group we were in, found out stuff you'd never know about boys, and I think all found it such a useful experience, but initially were so kind of pig-headed and didn't think it was useful.
And of course, Simo, as we've already alluded to, you are in this incredibly mature environment where if you give the slightest gap for the opposition to get through, they're going to look to exploit it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're a unique bunch of individuals, and it takes a unique type of person and character to do what we do. Like, you're knocking lumps out of each other, and we're encouraged to do so and encouraged to be pretty violent. So you've got to balance that with the mental side of things and our weaknesses, which we have a fair few of, I'd say.
But I think rugby, if you look at it as a sport, it's intriguing for me, coming from football, where let's say you don't always get the most mature stance from the players that play, especially when you're looking at conduct on the pitch. I quite honestly feel that in your environment, there's such a huge mutual respect that if you were aware, for example, that other players on the opposite team were suffering, obviously and still active, that it wouldn't go beyond, you know, the line of respect and what's said. And I think that is massive. And what we need to do is understand how that's been established, because so many other sports can learn from that. And that's, for me, that's one of the main reasons I watch rugby. A, it's the closest to goalkeeping you can ever get, and I can see a few, you know, people getting really stuck in, so I love it. But B, that element of respect and commonality towards, look, we're here to perform, but once that whistle goes, that's it, and it's done. You know, like Simo said, you can be kicking lumps out of each other 10 seconds before, but as soon as that whistle blows, you're shaking hands and, well done, mate, well played. And we need to understand how that's established, how culturally, how that's been done, and how we can relay that into other industries, because I really feel there's a lot to learn from that.
One issue we do have is we're not in permanent employment. So let's say I was in a really bad place, was for a while, opened up maybe to management, need to take some time away. There's no getting away from the fact that that will have an impact on my contract negotiations. Like, let's not cut around it. Like, that is going to have an issue. Oh, that's going to be an issue.
Even if they said,
you know, anyone out there, yeah, absolutely fine, take some time away. As a player, you feel like you're letting teammates down because you're out of action. You know, you've got a mortgage to pay, next contract, the snowball effect of that is huge. And therefore, you're never going to want to, that's a very tough conversation to have. And therefore, you put your head in the sand, you carry on, and we all know that's not the best thing to do, but it happens a lot.
I wonder as well, and as you were coming through at Falcons, you had an uber obsessive in Johnny Wilkinson, and obviously he's been very open with his mental health issues. I wonder whether those elite performers that absolutely put themselves under so much pressure, there is a very fine line between being a top sports performer and pushing yourself so far that you tip yourself over the edge. You know what he used to be like. He'd stay out for another 150 kicks on his own.
Yeah, and it was quite interesting as a younger guy coming through, because you saw how successful Johnny was. You kind of thought that was the only way to be. So we had some younger guys were quite obsessive about trying to obviously replicate what Johnny had done. I think Johnny would say himself that he probably didn't, in hindsight, enjoy the experiences and what he achieved, because he was constantly beating himself up or striving for better and better. But on the flip side of that, as you sort of allude to, would he have been him if he hadn't been that way? There's a fine balance. You look at, I don't know, the likes of a Gazza from a football perspective. Would Gazza have been Gazza if he hadn't have been a bit crazy away from the field? It's kind of, we're looking at these things in hindsight and trying to kind of contextualize them, but actually that's what made them who they were, essentially.
And I'm about to cut you a little bit of slack here on the England-Australia thing, but as one of the great sporting cultures, can the whole of a culture be that way inclined? Can everybody as a force be far too obsessed? Is there a point where, again, as captain, you have to pull them back a wee bit just to get that bit of subjectivity?
Yeah, well, I think there is, you know, particularly Australia, we're not a big country in terms of population, but we do have that obsessive nature, particularly with our national teams. We expect success, and that's knowing, you know, particularly you look at the Australian cricket team, they're expected to win based on the successes that have been before, and the Wallabies, our national team was no different, because, you know, the successes that have come you know, particularly the early part of the professional era, that we had such great success. That was what the public did. And then you have on the on top of that, the extra stresses of the financial state of the game, because you're in competition with so many other sports. I think we're the only country in the world that has three fully professional, full contact sports that play at the same time, that go for the same fans, the same kids, the same sponsorship dollars. That's then put on top, you know, you need to be winning to fill the stands, to make sure there's people watching, but make sure that you're going to get paid by the end of it. And I think it's, you know, it's trying to get that balance right. And I think that's the difficulty with it. And I think that, you know, you look at all, you know, coming even over here with the kids are getting into the sports much younger and, you know, honing in onto one thing from such an early age. They don't have blink to look on what's going on in the real world. And I think in all sports, particularly rugby as well, you know, we're getting kids from such a young age, and that's all they're worried about. We're going to be a professional rugby player, I'm going to finish school, I'm going to go to the Queen's Academy, I'm not going to worry about education, I'm just going to play rugby. And they get to a point where it doesn't happen anymore. And they're like, all their mates are sort of 5-6 years down the path or that they've already been on, back from when they were, you know, when we can, I think we can be better at balancing that throughout the first part of their career. Because if the career goes the way you want it to, the early part is the time that you've got more time to do stuff compared to when you get to a 30, you've got kids, you know, you've got so much other pressures, you're playing professional, you're playing at the top level, you're much more time poor than you are as an 18-year-old straight out of school, you know, where you think that, you know, I've got no time because I've got to train all the time. Well, you've got way more time. And I even look back at my time. I should have done more university when I first came out of school than I did. I did a couple of years, and it's taken me 16 years basically to finish a university degree that I started in 2003 when I finished school because of rugby.
Of course.
And then I got to the point of I'll get to it. And as my career went along a path that got better along the path I wanted it to do, to, you know, play the top level, be captain of your country and things like that, but your time just gets taken away from you. And I think we've got to be better at encouraging younger guys coming into the system.
I think the biggest part of that, of getting, you sort of look at it within squads, you've got the older guys who are terrified because they know the end is nigh. The middle group are invincible because they've been paid well and not care in the world. And the younger guys who actually are probably the most easily influenced. Mm-hmm. And if you can normalise activity away from the playing, but also see it as part of the performance side of things. Mm. There's loads of studies now to suggest that actually your engagement away from sport alongside the training actually makes you not only a better person, but a better player. It's changing that mindset, I guess, from a coach's perspective and a player's perspective, that's part of the performance alongside doing your weights, doing your rugby training. It's normalising that as part of who you are as an athlete.
Yeah. I think
the danger has been that historically, coaches have always thought, if you do that, it's coming at a cost of what you do on the pitch, right? I think, like as you say, so the research that's been undertaken in Australia has shown the cognitive development of a person allows them to filter thought under pressure quicker. So that means that you're ticking a box for the coach, right? The gaffer's happy because it means you're going to be a better player. Obviously, what that then allows you to do is have a wider viewpoint when you're looking at the world beyond. I think, you know, the point we're looking at here is the narrative that's being used towards self-development. You know, the kids that are coming up, this should be normalised, as you said, Tate, where you do this, being part of an athlete is broadening your horizons.
I think it also then, sort of talking about getting to the root cause of the mental health side of things, actually the anxiety around having a qualification or having an interest is a huge part in alleviating that mental health issue. As an athlete, you do have time in between training. As a rugby player, I suspect 20% of your career, if not more, is going to be spent injured. So actually to have a focus away from the day-to-day, I think alleviates that mental health issue that we've kind of been talking about.
And that, you go.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really helped me. I think I've had 5 major injuries in the last 2 years, so plenty of time out on the sidelines. And I think at the beginning, I really, really struggled because my identity was so tightly tied up in being a successful rugby player, playing, doing well, looking good, doing it. Like the whole, that was what I want. That was how I saw myself. And then when that's taken away from you, I felt pretty low, pretty empty, kind of the bottom of the roller coaster, like Kev talked about. But then kind of putting my energies into a history degree I do, doing stuff outside, even like concentrating more on family and stuff like that, and realizing that it is just a small part of me as an individual, helped me so much, and I think helps me now, well, I'm injured at the moment, but when I'm fit,
yeah,
helps me as a rugby player and kind of backs up that stuff you said, kind of that academia says.
So we've been speaking about contract lengths, right? Now, what that will do is install a short-term cycle thought process for you as individuals. Yeah. So that what it inherits a danger that anything you then would want to commit to that's longer term is scary.
Yeah.
A history degree, a master's, whatever that resides itself in, right? By allowing you again to talk about it, we can start to stretch that visualization of time frame, what's important. But then also, as you say, Simo and I spoke about it the other week, to commit yourself to a degree, I went from high school, I did an A-level leisure and tourism while I was at Luton, and then I went nothing, and then I did an MBA. Not advisable, but if you've got something, so a lot of the research I've done has been based upon Australia, America, because they were sort of a decade or two ahead of us in terms of success. You need that flexibility of approach, because as you say, if you start to go too heavy too fast, the panic button gets hit, and then all of a sudden you go, no, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. That's not for me today. I'll wait till I'm 30. Yeah. I'll wait till I'm 33. If we've got something in place that can be facilitated, that doesn't hinder your training, you can do on the move, or you can do during when you're injured I've been there on the couch a few times, get an ultrasound or whatever it is. I think it will just help us to shift the way that we speak about self-development and the level of acceptance towards it.
If you're a regular listener to Blood, Sweat and Fears, you'll know that Scott and I regularly reach our allotted time and still have lots more to discuss with our guests. And that's certainly true of James Horwell, Aaron Morris, Matty Simmons and Matthew Tate. So rather than cut them short, we're going to once again make this a two-parter. So for the time being, I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Look out for part two. Goodbye.